It's very nice that the church is welcoming us this morning.
Yeah, yes, yes.
I wasn't sure they knew about our event, but obviously they do.
But I'll bet you it's a low mass.
I'll ask the panelists to refrain until it's their time. My name is Donna Wilson, and I'm the executive director of the center, which is a community center serving and supporting lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual people and our allies, all in one breath. And I'm a member of the Seniors Initiative. I want to welcome everybody this morning. It's great to see such a turnout. I know for some this is often the beginning of people's day. For others, this may be midday already. So whatever the case is for you, it's great that you're here. This is an important event and one of what we hope of many, many initiatives and forums and community gatherings looking at issues of ageism, aging, and LGBT seniors. I wanted to start by giving you some information about how the Lesbian, Gay, Transgender, Bisexual Seniors Initiative came together. Earlier this year, around the end of winter, the center invited a few folks together to begin some dialogue, some discussion, and some planning, recognizing that there is a lack of resources for lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual seniors in our communities, a lack of awareness, and not many opportunities to talk about aging, ageism, and the needs of seniors. I think that one of the most positive things about this is that it is a coalition of not only interested individuals, agencies, it also brings together two groups from the Vancouver-Richmond Health Board, the Seniors Population Health Advisory Committee and the Queer Population Health Advisory Committee. So some positive things have happened since that time, some positive ally building as well. From about late April, we have been meeting every 2 to 3 weeks. So it's been an intense process, and we're glad to be at this. This is actually the second time that the Seniors Initiative has sponsored an event in our communities. The first time was at Out on Screen. We sponsored the screening of Living with Pride, Ruth Ellis at 100. And for those of you who've heard this week that Ruth Ellis died October 5th at age 101. So for any who saw that film, we know the importance of gatherings and opportunities where we hear from elders in our communities and we hear the kinds of history that people bring through their personal experiences. Early meetings of the initiative focused on the name. What words would we use? What name would we use to describe what it is we're up to? And we found that it's challenging, and I think we're all aware of this, it's challenging when we're talking about working across diverse population groups. Queer isn't a word that fits for everybody. Dyke isn't a word that fits for all lesbians, and so on. And to capture not only the diverse population groups, but also the fact that we're talking about the process of aging, the experiences of ageism, and the realities, the experiences, and the needs of seniors. And even seniors is not a word that everybody feels comfortable with. I know folks that say, don't call me a senior, don't call me older. Older than what? Call me old. Or don't call me any of those things, just see me as a person. So we recognize that language is a challenge in this process, and we encountered those kinds of challenges. So when we settled on Lesbian, Gay, Transgender, Bisexual Seniors Initiative, bringing visibility to aging and ageism, it was the best we could do at the time to kind of give people a flavor of what it is that we want to be doing. And as I said before, we hope that this is one of many different forums, community gatherings, activities around these important issues. And there'll be opportunities throughout the day for you to give your input to the future, to participate in future meetings and plannings and activities. One of the ways is through a comment board outside of this room, just outside of this room to the right. Another way is there's a form that everybody may have gotten. If you haven't, they're out at the table. And this is a way that you can talk about and let us know how you'd like to be involved in the future. I want to say thanks to 411 Seniors for giving us the opportunity to meet here. This forum originally was going to be at the Roundhouse Community Center, and with the City of Vancouver strike, we needed to do some fancy footwork and find another place. So we're glad to have a spot here. Some of the breakout rooms are not as ideal as we would like them to be, so we just wanted to ask everybody to bear with that and to make use of the space that we have, and at least we do have some different spaces for each one of the breakout sessions this morning and this afternoon. Washrooms are just outside here on either side of the elevator, so when you need a break, take it, and that's where they are. There is another group meeting on this floor this morning in the room called the Sewing Room. That's at the far end of the hall. So if you keep that in mind when moving around during breaks and the breakout session times, that there are other folks on the floor between 10 and 12, and we'll have the floor all to ourselves this afternoon. Security, this building is open until 2 p.m. this afternoon. If you need to leave and come back in or leave, the door will be locked at 2, and there will be somebody downstairs to make sure that you can come and go as you need. Evaluation forms. I know it's the dreaded evaluation forms that every event asks you to fill out, and they are very important because this will give us some clear feedback from you folks and will help us plan future events. So if you don't have one already, please pick one up and take a few minutes to fill it out before the end of the day. As you've noticed, we do have some media folks here, and we have very clearly arranged so that media will not be part of the breakout sessions, because those are places we wanted people to be able to share personally in comfort and with a sense of safety. But it is great that somebody's here from Outlook, so I understand this clips from this event will be on two different Outlook shows. That's great. And are you from Extra West, by any chance? No? Is there anybody here from Extra West? We did. Okay. We know we've got somebody here from Outlook, and that's really great. Okay, there's an info table outside, and as I said before, a place where you can also leave your comments. Committee members for this event, the Seniors Initiative committee members, have little rainbow flags on their name tags. And I know I've already been told that's discriminatory. We wanted to find some way to stand out a little bit from the crowd, so that if any of you have any questions, you have any comments, you want to talk with one of us directly, please look for folks with rainbow flags. In the interest of health and well-being, because that's a part of today, please take breaks as you need them. We've got breaks throughout the day, both refreshment breaks in the morning and the afternoon. Actually, no break in the afternoon, right? In the morning, and then the lunch break. But do take breaks as you need them. Get some food, some refreshments as you need. Use the washrooms as you need. Stand up, walk around. Do whatever it is you need to do to make this an enjoyable day for yourselves. For any questions about logistics of the day, I'm just going to run through the agenda quickly. Anything that I've left out to initiative members? Okay, tried to capture it all. So this morning we're starting with a panel that is called Sharing Our History, Sharing Our Herstory. And the panel will be an hour and 15 minutes, so we're asking panelists to speak for about 15 minutes. And we'll have a bit of time for comments and questions. And just to let you know, we are recording these two panels, the morning and afternoon panels, as one of the ways of capturing some of the stories within our communities. We'll then move to a refreshment break at 11:45 till noon. Breakout groups, and they're designated in various areas. We didn't know the size of the groups or the needs of the breakout groups. Lesbian breakout group will be here. Gay men's breakout group will be the far end of the hall. Bisexual breakout group and transgender bisexual group will be in the two inner rooms. And depending on the size of the groups, I ask people to just kind of go, those two groups to go where it is appropriate for you to be, where everybody can be comfortable. We'll have lunch from noon to 1 o'clock. No, noon to 12:30. No, 12:30 to 1. I'm looking at an old agenda here. Get with the program, Wilson. Okay. 1 to 1:30 is lunch. Okay, then panel number 2, which is... And it's provided. Thank you, Ellen. And lunch will be set up in this room. And then we'll move to panel 2, which is called Coming Out at Different Ages and Stages. And the afternoon workshops, again, we'll use these same spaces except for the sewing room. We'll be in that room this afternoon for one of the sessions. And we'll talk a little bit later about those sessions. So I want to move on to the panel and let you know who our speakers are. And the words that I'm going to share about the speakers are words that they've shared with us themselves. To my far left is Gordon Bolan. Gordon is 66 years of age and has been aware of being different from a very early age. He has lived with his partner for over 23 years. Gordon worked in the healthcare industry for over 30 years, with some time out to work in the food industry, as well as a couple of years as an attendant at a local steam bath. Gordon says, be sure to ask him about garlic. Gordon is also a member of the Prime Timers, Vancouver Prime Timers, and treasurer and coordinator of the Dining Out group. To my left is Stephanie Castle. Stephanie is 10 weeks shy of her 75th birthday. She is a transsexual who transitioned 10 years ago. She is an ex-Navy officer and also worked in the shipping business for a number of years. Since retiring, Stephanie is the author of 10 published books, including ones on transsexual issues as well as maritime history. Stephanie has grown children who are very supportive. To my right is Jackie Barrio. Jackie is a lesbian born in 1934 at Vancouver General Hospital. While a native of Vancouver, Jackie has traveled quite a bit through the years with her partner of many years. And to my extreme right is Ellen Woodsworth, who is 52, identifies as a lesbian. Ellen is presently the coordinator of the Senior Summit of the Neighborhood Helpers and the Downtown Eastside Senior Center. Okay, chairperson for the Bridge Housing Society for Women, past president of Britannia Community Center, and part of many other nonprofit boards. Ellen is co-founder of the first lesbian feminist group, support group? Okay, support group in Canada, and the founder of The Other Woman newspaper, founder and editor. And Ellen has been an activist within our communities for social justice all her life. So we've got a great panel of speakers. I just want to run through quickly the kinds of questions that we asked our panelists to think about, to be guided by in their sharing this morning. What was your experience of community when you first came out? What community resources, if any, were available to you, meaning social, recreational clubs, support groups, activist groups? What changes have you seen and experienced over the years in the LGBT communities? What is it like to be an older LGBT person in our community? How have you experienced ageism within the LGBT communities? And what do you most appreciate about where you are in your life, so where you are being your current age? So without further ado, I'd like to ask Gordon to start us off, and panelists will be speaking for 15 minutes, and I'll give everybody a sign at about 13 minutes so that you can wrap up. Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you, Donna. And good morning, everybody. Before I start my speech and you ask me about garlic, I'd like to tell a little joke. Two men were approaching each other on a street in America, and both men were dragging their right foot. So as they neared each other, the one man points to his foot and says, Vietnam, 69. The other man points to his foot and says, dog shit, 20 feet back. Now we'll get down to some serious business. The reason I asked that the note be put in there about garlic, but garlic patch, is because it reminds me of an incident that happened to me when I was about 5 years old. And that was my first encounter with another male, although he was also a child, but he was about 2 or 3 years older than I. And where I was living at this time, we had a sawdust house because they didn't have the big refrigeration units at this time. And we used to meet in the sawdust pile. Now, he tried to have anal sex with me, but we were just too young. But I always remember that as my first experience. So then, as I grew, I knew I was different. I knew there was something about me that didn't fit the mold. Because everything I was doing up to this point, I felt was so natural that I never questioned it. And I suppose coming from a small town, you'd think I might have, would have been a bit more aware, but I wasn't. So things progressed. I tried the doctor-nurse routine. That didn't interest me. Then I found, men did interest me. And every opportunity I had, I would find myself next to the closest male. I could never figure out for years and years and years why I was put on a curfew. And that's why. My mother knew I was different too, and she was trying to protect me. Little did she know that by the time I reached grade 8, I was going out my lunch hours at school and picking up men. Now, I didn't know what a pedophile was. All I knew is they were older, they had a penis, it got hard, and I liked it. And I liked the smell of sex. And then we go on from there. It got to a point when I reached high school that I took up friendship with another very effeminate male. And of course, this is where I began to find out what the difference was, because I was ostracized. But I never knew why I was ostracized. I mean, he was just another person. He was a little different. I was a little different. So we got on well. Except we were excluded from a lot of activities. I reached a point in my life where I needed to get away from the small town. And so I joined the Air Force. Now, in those days, you could not be gay and be in the Air Force. But again, I didn't feel that I was gay. I didn't know what gay was. I didn't feel there was anything wrong with me. So I spent 8 years in the Air Force. And it was shortly after I was in the Air Force that I did find out there was a big difference. And so therefore, I ran into the closet. In 1962, when they amalgamated the forces, I got my discharge, or asked for my discharge. And at that same time, the base commander called me into his office and told me that he was going to recommend I be discharged because I was a homosexual. But I said, well, I don't think so. I had a girlfriend. I would have married her, except when I went out to buy the engagement ring, I thought, uh-oh, there's something wrong here. This is not what I want. So because I had been in the closet for quite a while by then, I decided maybe I better go out and find out if this is exactly what I wanted to do. And sure enough, this is what I wanted to be. This who is who I was. So I took my discharge, and then I came here to Vancouver. I was stationed out at Sea Island. There was an Air Force base there. And I took my discharge out here, and then I started coming out into the community. And I found it a very, very strange community. I identified more with the feminine side of the male homosexual. In those days, we were called fluffy sweaters, which differentiated us from the sort of Levi crowd. And that was fine, because I had a hell of a good time doing that. But one thing I did forget to tell you is an experience I had is after I got out of the Air Force, I went back to my little town and took my LPN training. And it was during that period I suffered a depression. And I didn't know why. And so I went off to the nearest big center and spoke with a psychiatrist, and we spoke for about a half hour, and he said, go home, pick up a man, do what it is you need to do, and get on with your life. Well, that's exactly what I did. And then I moved back out to Vancouver in the mid-60s. And as I say, it was a very different story then. We didn't have clubs or the licensed bars or things like that that exist today. We had places called the New Fountain, the Vanport, Hotel Vancouver, the Castle Hotel, and I'm talking in these days specifically with the Castle Hotel, where you were split, males on one side and ladies with escorts on the other side. So, of course, we were always on the other side because we made sure we had a lady with us. And that's how we survived there. Hotel Vancouver didn't matter. Their bar was open. But in those days, it was the older male that sort of hung out in Hotel Vancouver. Excuse me. We also had the steam baths as a sexual outlet for us. And this was long before anybody knew about AIDS or somebody discovered about AIDS. And so we had the steam baths, the hotels, and the parties after the hotel closed. Everybody would grab a case of beer to find out who was throwing the house party that night. And that's how we entertained ourselves, was that way. And then as things progressed, in those days too, shortly after that, the Montreal Club came into existence down on Hastings Street. I don't know if anybody remembers that far back, but it was fun. A lot of the drag queens hung out there. And it's the only place in Vancouver where I really got into difficulty with the drag queen, because she thought I was trying to steal her boyfriend. And that was a rough neighborhood. And if people hadn't started coming around, I'm sure she'd have kicked the shit out of me. That's how tough she was. But I digress, because I was going to tell you of an incident that happened in Fort Frances when I was taking my nursing career. And that was when I was having the depression and went in. And on the course, the psychiatrist sent a summary back to my doctor. It was a clinic of 9 doctors. And the word got around in that clinic that I was gay, and I was in the nursing program, and one doctor demanded I be kicked off the program. That's the Catholic hospital. The nun in charge of the hospital called the doctor in and myself in and said to him, you don't run the hospital, I do. Gordon, go back to class. The only thing is, this man would never allow me, if he could help it, to have any physical contact with any of his patients. Now that's when I found out about prejudice. That was the key there.
They are now, of course, in their 40s. They've been quite supportive and understanding of my particular situation, which goes back to the age of roughly 3, I would say, when I first got a message from nature which said that there was something a little strange about me. The strange thing was that even though I was very much of a boy, I actually wanted to be a girl. And I had absolutely no logical explanation for this as to why I thought this or anything else. Now, keep in mind, I was born in the year 1925. I estimate that if I was 3.5 years old when this came, which I think I probably was, because I remember it being a very hot summer, there was absolutely no knowledge of anything to do with this kind of thing. It was not something you could bring to the attention of a parent with any hope of them having any helpful knowledge or notions or anything along these lines. And it was probably even worse still with doctors. there was absolutely no knowledge of the situation which we've come to recognize as being transsexual, or transsexuality, if you like. It so happened also that my father was a very strict and highly opinionated man, rather like an English version of Archie Bunker, and getting anything through to him at any stage of my life was always somewhat difficult. Dealing with a situation like this, had I tried to bring it to his attention to get any help, would have just been a total waste of time, and it would probably resulted in some very unpleasant circumstances, so far as I was concerned. You know, as a kid, you quickly grab onto these things which affect your life, and I quickly understood that this was a shameful situation. I felt ashamed of the possibility that anybody would ever find out about this. Having said that, how could I ever expect anybody to know anything about it if I couldn't communicate with them? You feel as though you're completely cut off from the outside world. And it was a lonely existence because, you know, I was like something spinning out in space someplace without any ability to communicate with anyone. So I always did very masculine things because that seemed to be the way in which I could hide my inner femininity. I was a good rugby player at school. I was a very good wrestler in my teens. I joined the Navy at the age of 17 in 1943, so I'm a vet of the Second World War. And I suppose because of the particular type of personality I have, I did advance quite quickly in the Navy, and in a period of 4 years, I went from being a seaman to a lieutenant, which was the rank I had when I was eventually discharged. I had a spell in the Naval Commandos, was involved in some of the invasions in the Far East when the tide of war was turning against the Japanese. I suppose, in a way, I could have been regarded as being ye typical swashbuckling male who did things and was proud to wear a uniform and was proud to belong to the Navy and so forth. But always in the back of my mind was this little specter of transsexuality. I was, while I was in the Navy, it caused me no problems. I kept it well hidden. I remember going into a bookstore in Bombay. Oh, by the way, I should tell you that up until that time, I had really no firm idea what my sexual orientation was. I was attracted to girls, and I had several girlfriends, but I was worried that I might be homosexual. Now, this is the type of conflict that goes on in a junior's mind and causes all sorts of crises, I don't doubt. But when I joined the Navy, was in the Navy and I went into a bookstore in the port of Bombay, India, I came across a book called Man into Woman, quite a well-known book, which was written, I think, about 1937, and it gave details of the first known transsexual operation, which took place in Vienna in 1933. When an Austrian doctor operated on a Danish artist. It was not a successful operation. The artist died about 6 months later. There was a rudimentary knowledge of the male and female sex hormones, but it was not a detailed knowledge, and there was no such thing, as I understand it, of manufactured hormones or anything like that. So one of the processes in this operation was to try to transfer the gonads of a woman into this male and so forth. And that's, I gather, is where it came unstuck. The operation was very complicated, and she got pneumonia and died. However, the one thing about the book was that if the first time I had some kind of a horizon to work with, I knew at that point that this particular individual's problem had been the same as mine now was, how to deal with this particular situation within me. I didn't know where to turn. I did go through a period of considerable consternation after reading the book. Fortunately, I was able to keep it well hidden. Eventually, I was discharged from the Navy and went back to civilian life and met a girl and got married. I was 23. And then we came to Canada in 1952. It was a reasonably happy marriage in the early stages, and we had children, and that was probably the best time of our lives, our married life. Unfortunately, the marriage deteriorated, and after 25 years came to an end, and I again went into one of these crisis modes. How am I going to deal with this transsexual situation? By now, I had a bit more knowledge of it, that the Christine Jorgensen thing had been and gone, and I even phoned up in 1973, I would think it was, about 1972 or 73, I phoned up Dr. Benjamin's office in New York to try to get some sort of a handle on how to handle this, because there was nothing in Vancouver at that stage. In fact, I'm not even sure the Clark Institute in Toronto had started, but if it had, it was in its infancy, and I certainly didn't know anything about it. So, of course, the receptionist was very helpful, and she said, because you'll have to come down to New York to be interviewed and all this kind of stuff. So it seemed to be an impossibility. There were too many logistical problems. There were financial problems and so forth. And, of course, with a marriage which was had gone on the rocks, it was made more complicated. So fortunately or unfortunately, I'm not sure which when I look back, I met another lady and we courted for a while and lived together for a short while and then married. Well, that marriage turned out after 14 years to be a total disaster. Fortunately, there were no children. Religion intervened. She became an extreme religious bigot and it became almost impossible to live with her. So after 14 years, we terminated the marriage and I moved on and went through a considerable crisis again. So this time I thought, well, I'm going to deal with this and get rid of it. I've got to deal with it one way or the other. Either that or it's going to kill me eventually. So I got medical advice and I did go to the clinic at the Vancouver Hospital which deals with transsexual situations. And really, that was a great watershed in my life because from that point on I really never looked back. I was virtually destitute at the beginning of 1989, I guess, and I had to borrow money off my daughter to sort of keep my head above water. And of course, when you start borrowing money off your children, it's never really the happiest kind of situation. They can become rather strange bankers, and of course, they threaten to undermine our relationship for a period of time, but I went to the clinic and got some professional advice and some help from psychiatrists, and they agreed that I was transsexual. They agreed that I should do something about it, and they would help me. And it meant a course of treatment which was easily, but 2 years ahead anyhow. But the important thing was I got my confidence back, and in that year, from being destitute in January of 1989, I made $90,000 of income selling real estate. So that's what confidence can do for you, and that's what they gave me. They gave me my confidence back. The clinic was probably more important in those days than it is now as a support organization. Because since then, we have developed a number of support facilities which help transsexuals. Myself and three others started the Zenith Foundation in 1992. This was after I'd had my surgery. We came to the conclusion that whilst the gays and the lesbians and others had their quite substantial and strong groups, there was nothing for the transsexual per se. So we started the Zenith Foundation, and it's been quite a successful organization. It doesn't really have an enormous membership because there aren't that many transsexuals. But we do have membership across Canada. We publish a magazine. We run support groups. We do all the usual things. We also publish pamphlets that help people who've got this condition. A lot of us, of course, relied very heavily on this sort of transsexual support group and everything that went with it. Some of us, of course, found our way down to the various gay and lesbian clubs, where, incidentally, they felt relatively, or as far as I know, very secure, because there was no severe prejudice against them as there would be if they went into regular places like the Vancouver Hotel and so forth that Gordon was mentioning earlier. We've seen a very considerable change in the transsexual situation. First of all, when I first came out of the woodwork and dealt with this, it was almost a foregone conclusion that you'd be out of a job. That was in 1989. A relatively well-known person in our community, Angela Wensley, showed the way. She stuck her situation out and went right through the whole process while she worked for Macmillan and Bloedel. She was a senior researcher. You know, and it dawned on a lot of people, look, if she can do it, so can I. And it's amazing how many people now are actually changing on the job. And of course, with the aid of human rights legislation, it's become a good deal easier. And, you know, we try to encourage people in Zenith, A, to normalize their lives and their new role and their chosen new gender, and to stick it out. Don't go into a funky kind of retreat and pack your job up because you're going to feel embarrassed that somebody might criticize you because you're wearing lipstick or something along those lines. Stick it out. And it's interesting how many people nowadays, I would say probably about two-thirds of people are successfully changing on the job that I know of. So it's made it a lot easier to handle. Finally, what do I most appreciate in my own life? I guess the biggest thing is good health. I've had two serious illnesses in the last 5 years, and I'm happy to say I seem to have made a complete recovery. Strong believer in the work ethic. I've always worked, and I work to this day very actively as an author. I do journalistic assignments of one sort or another, and I've done research projects for film. And as far as I'm concerned, this is the recipe for staying healthy, stay active for as long as you possibly can. As long as you've got energy up here, wind in your lungs, good heart, stick it out. I fully expect to work until I'm 85. That's my target. That is, so far as I'm concerned, the recipe for good health. This business of let's play golf all the time, let's fiddle about in the garden, no dice, it doesn't work. So that's my message to you.